So I must have been a young child when this happened. Me and my sister were hanging out at my mom's work at the university. Her office was just two doors down from her best friend's office, who also happened to be the mother of my best friend. So we got brought to work a lot. You know, we just hung out in the kind of collective supervision that parents who trust each other at their workplace have about their children, told, of course, not to touch any of the really expensive equipment that I thought really looked like light brights. Either way. So we're hanging out in Heather, my mom's friend's office, and my sister, who might have been 4 or 5 at the time, goes over to Heather and says, "Do you want to know a secret about my mom?" Now, let me give you a hint, or a tip, if a child ever tells you, "Do you want to hear a secret?" you always should say yes. And in this case, Heather said yes. So my sister leaned in close, like she was about to share news that no one else should hear, something so secret, maybe something shameful, maybe something that was not for public consumption. She leaned in, cupping her hands, and whispered, "My mom dyes her hair." This was not a surprise to Heather. Having known my mother for the last 20, 30 years, my mother started dyeing her hair when her hair turned gray in her early 20s. This is not something new. But somehow, my sister had picked up that there was some sort of taboo about this, that there was something hidden about this. Maybe it was simply the fact that this hair dyeing happened in private at home or at the hairdressing studio, and so it wasn't something that everyone saw. Maybe it was this sense that there was a little duplicity, right? That you were doing something to become something that you maybe weren't naturally. Or maybe she'd picked up on some of the various messages that our culture has about bodies and about what a good body is or what we should say about bodies. Either way, something told her that this was a secret, and as a young child, she was playfully testing out what could be said about what. We, as a culture, are steeped in stories about bodies, messages about good bodies, bad bodies, healthy bodies, unhealthy bodies, bodies that are normal, bodies that are aberrant, bodies that are dangerous to us, bodies that may be endangered by us, bodies that should be pitied or looked to for inspiration, bodies or parts of bodies to be hidden, filled with shame, never to be shared or touched or acknowledged. Now, I used that word steeped intentionally because it is very much the case that we are infused with these messages from the time we are born. It is not just what people say, but it's how they act. It's how we read between the lines of people's actions and their stories. We are steeped in these messages that attach to our minds, to our hearts, and also start to begin to live within us. They live within us, sometimes disconnecting us from parts of ourselves and our bodies, or they make us hyper aware of other parts. What I loved about Hannah's story is that unlike so many people in our culture, so many young people in our culture, the messages that she absorbed as she grew up were so positive, that were instilled and steeping her in a sense of deep dignity and worthiness of her body, of its gifts, of its power. But I wonder what messages you absorbed about bodies and about your body when you were growing up. I wonder what you were taught about the worthiness of bodies. Now, it's easy for us in our culture, which is hyper-focused on weight and size, to only think about that when we're in this area of talking about bodies, but there's so much more than that. There's questions about the purpose of bodies. Were you told that the purpose of the body was for pleasure and connection and joy? Or was the purpose of the body simply to be the vessel that got you through? Were the messages that you got about who your body belonged to affirmed that it was you, that you were the person that your body belonged to, or were the messages that your body actually belonged to other people, whether the government or your parents or someone else? These stories about who our bodies belong to can be deeply destructive because they start to become stories of who gets to decide about what we do with our bodies. Many of us might have grown up with stories that told us that our bodies were sources of temptation and sin, that we should not seek their wisdom or their guidance, for it would lead us to eternal damnation. Well, others of us might have absorbed messages that told us that our bodies were sources of wisdom, that their messages were to be honored, to be listened to. I put on Facebook a few weeks ago this question: what were you taught about your bodies, and what has your body taught you? And I was struck with how many people shared stories about how, as they grew up, they were told that their body was not something they should connect to. It'll be all right. Just get over that hurt. You're not really sick. We're doing this as a family. It doesn't matter what you think. Or stories of going to a doctor and sharing your symptoms and not being believed, being told that it was all in your head. These experiences of pain, these experiences of disease were not true. Heard stories of family members and a society that said that the inner knowledge you had about what your body should be like, about what parts it should have, and the path to have a body that conforms to the gender that is yours alone was broken up, barriers placed into that deep affirmation. I heard stories of our parents who maybe spoke good words about bodies, but in their actions deprecated their own bodies through dieting, controlling, critiquing. It is scary to speak about bodies, because when we speak about bodies, our bodies start to speak back. You may be noticing that. Maybe it's tension, restriction, expansion. Maybe it's a sense of calm or ease. Energy or numbness, these are the words that your body uses to speak to you about what it is experiencing. In her book, Your Body is Not an Apology, the Black activist and poet Sonia Renee Tyler tells of a moment that she had with one of her best friends. They were at a poetry slam competition. They had traveled to another state. They had just performed in one of the competition days, and they were hanging out at the hotel room. Her friend had seemed tense the whole time. And so Sonia asked her, "Natasha, what's going on?" And her friend shared with her that she was afraid that she might have become pregnant. Now, both of them had been sexual health educators for a long time. So Sonia asked, "Well, did you use protection?" And she said, "No." She asked, "Why?" She looked at her friend. Natasha had lived with cerebral palsy her whole life. This is a condition that affects the muscular and skeletal system. And her friend turned to her and said, "My disability makes sex harder. And I just didn't feel like it was okay to make a big deal about using condoms." Sonia writes, "Her words pricked something painful, some painful underbelly of knowing in my own body when I heard this. My entire being rang in resonance. I was transported to all the times I had given away my own body in penance. A reel of memories scrolled through my mind of all the ways I had told the world I was sorry for having this wrong, bad body. After hearing that confession from her friend, Sonia replied, "Natasha, your body is not an apology. It is not something you give to someone to say, sorry for my disability." That phrase, "your body is not an apology," would go on to become the core of her activism. It spawned this beautiful spoken word poem that I advise you all to look at, but I'm going to quote just a bit of it. Sonia Renee writes, "The body is not soiled. It is not filth to be forgiven. The body is not calamity. The body is not a math test. The body is not a wrong answer. The body is not a failed class. You are not failing. The body is not an apology. The body is not crime. It is not sentence to be served." I love that last bit. The body is not crime. It is not sentence to be served. Because so many of us experience our bodies as a sentence to be served, a life sentence, actually, right? And yet, I think for many of us, we might have this spark, this sense within us that our bodies may, in fact, actually be worthy, that they might actually be whole, that there may be actual goodness in it, even though we are steeped in messages that don't say that. That spark is important. So this week, I brought our dog, Dolly, to work on Wednesday. I think I have a picture of Dolly. This is her dressed up. We adopted Dolly when she was about a year and a half when we were living in Boston. She was a wonderful, she is a wonderful dog, and we quickly realized she came with a lot of trauma. She came up from the South. We don't know much about her past, but as soon as we got her to her home, we started to notice some things that normally dogs don't do. Like, for example, refuse to eat for 3 days in a row. Most dogs don't do that. Most dogs love eating, in fact. And so we said, that's interesting. Another time, she refused to go outside for 3 days in a row. And I do mean refuse. She would get to the edge of the door, plant her feet, and begin violently shaking. So on the second day, thinking she's got to go sometime, I would pick her up, all 40 pounds of her, and walk the 2 blocks in Boston down to the park, looking like a complete idiot. People passing me on the street saying, "You know she has legs. They're not working." And so I would place her down in the park, and I would sit with her for an hour as she shook, usually to no avail. She came to us with a lot of trauma and a lot of knowing. We moved here to Colorado, and so we've been figuring out what triggers her. And so when we learned that we were going to have a new roof put on our house on Wednesday, we figured she probably shouldn't be there for all of those loud noises. So I brought her to work. It took her until just after lunch to start to feel comfortable in my office. She had sniffed around, found out where her water bowl was, found out where she should lie down, figured out where people come in and where people leave. She'd figured that all out. And so at about 3 o'clock, she would finally got to that place where she stretched herself out in that total body comfort. I don't know what they call it for dogs, but kind of spread eagle type position. I had a meeting that afternoon with Sarah Steen, the incoming board president, and she came in and she said, "Oh, is this your dog, the one that has all the trauma?" And I said, "Yes." Talked about her a lot. And Dolly jumped up, so full of joy, wagging her tail, greeting Sarah, And Sarah said, oh, it doesn't seem like she's struggling right now. And I said, well, yeah, we're in a good place now. So we continued with our meeting for a little bit of time, and then suddenly we started to notice that Dolly was getting tense. She was starting to shake. Her tail was going between her legs. She got close to the ground and was crawling kind of ninja style to try to find safety. Sarah looked at me and said, is this the trauma? And I said, yes. Now, there had been no loud noise. There had been nothing that would have precipitated this response from her. And Sarah asked, what is going on? And I said, well, if I know anything about her, I'm guessing that in about 40 minutes, we're going to have a thunderstorm. Because something in Dolly, something in her body, something about her sense of the world allows her to predict when thunderstorms are going to happen. They think it has something to do with sensing a change in pressure. And so even though when you looked outside, it pretty much looked like this, there was not a cloud really in the sky, it was sunny, it was bright, so all of my cognitive thoughts would not have told me that a thunderstorm was coming. Something in her body knew that something was about to happen. Something was telling her, pay attention, something's about to happen, listen up. Now, I had a meeting that evening, and we had a violent thunderstorm, so this is what Dolly decided to do. She found one of the cabinets in the RE building and stayed there for about an hour. I was very grateful that the board just allowed her to be. That wisdom that Dolly had about that thunderstorm is wisdom that we have too. As Bessel van der Kolk says, the body keeps the score, it never forgets, and it never lies. These responses that we have to the stimulus of our world, sometimes and most of the time unconsciously, are deep tidbits of wisdom for us to connect to. But it can be so, so difficult for us to understand what it's saying and to even notice that it's happening. I started to think about this. I mean, it's very clear when Dolly is hiding in a cabinet that something is wrong. But for most of us, we don't always sense that tension that we might be carrying, that sense of numbness that we get when we're around a certain person, that sense of ease that a certain activity brings us. We're not always in touch with it. And so I started to wonder what it would be like if our body would communicate to us, like through text messages. So I was playing out some hypothetical conversations, like this one, hanger alert. Hanger is that anger that is caused by hunger. I wondered if my body would send me this message, you have 15 minutes before irreversible hanger sets in. In kindness to yourself and everyone around you, please eat something now. That would be a great message to get, right? Or maybe this conversation. Hi there. It seems like you're getting pretty grumpy. That's you right now. Is it time to go to bed? Again, that would be so useful. Or maybe you've had a conversation like this with your body. I see that you're pushing yourself today, your body says. Have you thought about how that will feel tomorrow? You might respond, but it needs to get done. And your body might say, does it? Do you know that's for sure? What's the worst thing that might happen? And you might respond, everyone dies. Because sometimes it feels that way. And your body might say, I see that we're being very rational today. Because your body is a bit sassy, and you say, butt out. Or maybe the conversation is more like this. Hi there, I'm noticing you've been sitting still in a weird position for the last hour. I'm worried that you'll get stiff if you keep doing that. Would you like to get up and stretch for a minute and then reconsider your life choices? Your body's a little annoyed at you at that point. Or maybe the conversation less humorously is like this. Whoa, you're getting tense. That person's behavior reminds me of the behavior of several people who harmed you. How are you doing? Is it time to leave this situation to regroup? Better stay on the safe side. I wonder what it would be like if we could have our bodies communicate like that to us and how useful it would be to tap into that wisdom. Because modern neuropsychology tells us that our body is constantly communicating to us what we at a level and a depth of wisdom that we can't even understand, but it speaks in a language of three movements. It speaks in the language of constriction to expansion, a felt sense of constriction or expansion. It speaks to us in the language of pain or ease. It speaks to us in the language of numbness or energy. These are the words, this is the language that your body uses every single day to communicate to you something true. And in fact, emotions are our mind's process of trying to make sense of the specific combination of constriction and expansion, pain and ease, numbness or energy that your body is experiencing right now. Emotions aren't actually, the new science is showing us, something that is baked into us. It is something our culture gives us categories for to say, when your body is like this, you're feeling this. It's a kind of translation. I remember when I was in seminary, I was looking back at my dating history, and I was realizing that each time I had gotten into a relationship, the distance between the time that my body told me it should be over and it actually was getting shorter. Like, I noticed that each of the times in those relationships, I started to get a tension in my chest and kind of a numbness in my belly whenever the relationship wasn't going into a place of health or had the legs for the future. And that each of the successive relationships that I had, that there weren't many, many of them, but there were enough to, you know, have a hypothesis, that each of the times, the distance, the amount of time it took me to notice and connect into those systems was getting shorter. Started to feel good about that, even if I didn't feel good about some of the choices, but that's for another sermon, or maybe not. The reality is, though, that our body's wisdom, what it's telling us about our lives, it can break down at any point in the chain. It can break down in that felt sense when we don't notice what our body is telling us, because many of us are unpracticed at noticing that tension or that ease or that numbness. It can also break down if we disregard those experiences as valuable, as many of us were taught to disregard experiences of pain or dis-ease because someone else told us that we should. Or that maybe we should push past them because it needs to get done, or we're not going to be the type of person we need to be if we don't push past them. It can also break down in the realm of emotions. Many of us feel threatened by those feelings that come over us, and so we numb them out through all of our favorite vices, drugs, addictions, overworking, overexercising, eating. Or sometimes the cloud of shame over our bodies makes it so it is even hard to connect at all to any feelings about who we are. Or it breaks down when it gets to that place of our thoughts, that because we're steeped in such toxic messages that tell us that we are not worthy, that we don't even allow ourselves to experience goodness in our bodies, pleasure in our bodies, connection in our bodies, because of all of the thoughts. We don't do that activity that we love because of how we might look. We don't take pictures to remember memories because of how we might look. We don't touch our bodies, let our bodies be touched. We don't look at our bodies because of how it makes us feel ashamed. And yet, remember that spark? That spark that says that you might be worthy and whole, that your body is worthy and whole. Trying to get this name right, and I'm not going to. This beautiful poet by Nayid Wahid says this: "And I said to my body softly, I want to be your friend. It took a long breath and replied, I have been waiting my whole life for this. For your body is worthy, your body is whole, and it has wisdom to share if only you listen." I was reminded of this when I visited, you know, those water spouts in Old Town. Like, there's nothing more liberating than watching children play in those water spouts. I mean, it's literally the simplest thing water comes up randomly, and yet there they are, joyfully running, trying to stop the water from coming up with their hands, feeling the wetness and the sun, shrieking in joy at the surprise of the thing that happened over and over again. It's that same sense of joy and connection that I witness when a baby finds their feet for the first time. That sense of, wow, this is me. And it reminds me of something important. It reminds me that all of these messages, all of these thoughts, all of these experiences about our bodies are learned. They're not inborn. That everything that we do that disconnects us from the worthiness and the wisdom of our body, we've inherited. It's not inherent. And so we have the opportunity at any moment to interrupt it. And friends, this is scary stuff. Because when we talk about bodies, our bodies talk back. And as we wade deeper and speak about our bodies, they speak louder. And it is scary. And it is not comfortable to connect through the fog of disconnection. And yet, here is the truth that I hold on to all the time. Just because it's scary doesn't mean it's dangerous. May we be good stewards of that journey for each other. Amen.